From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the July 2021 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Top Secret Misinformation, Part 2. Last December, the entire podcast team got together after nearly a year of being apart, and we recorded the first part of a Q&A session from our listeners. Now, hopefully I'm not tempting fate with this, but we'd originally promised that this second part that we're recording now would be out in January this year. So 8 months later, we're all gathered together again. I've got with me
Erica Munro,
Thomas Cheetham,
David Kenyon,
and I'm the producer, Mark, and I'm going to take a back seat. I'm going to hand over to Erica, who does the job much better than me.
We have our historians gathered to answer our listeners' questions and hopefully bust a few myths along the way. What better thing to start with than a very well-worn quote? Tom, could you please tell us who described Bletchley Park as the goose that laid the golden eggs?
Yes, the short answer is nobody.
Excellent.
That's it, great. On the show. I hope the listeners all like that.
Yeah, right. this is a nice, easy one. The quote is normally attributed to Churchill, Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister. But as far as we know, he never said anything of the sort. The whole Bletchley Park story was completely secret for the rest of his lifetime. So he died in the 1960s. And we don't know that he spoke about it publicly in that way. And so the quote is apocryphal. We don't know who came up with it. And it seems to have made its way into the Bletchley Park mythology very firmly. And it's very hard to eradicate now. But it's just not true.
I did once try and track it down, and you find a footnote in one book and it references a second book, and you look in the second book and it references a third book, and you look in the third book and it references the first book again. So it's out there in multiple sources, but I couldn't run it down to anything credible anywhere.
Just the basis of it makes no sense, does it? Because why would he talk about something that was top secret knowing it was still being kept secret? It just didn't make any sense.
Maybe it was to those in the know, and those in the know were all now gone.
Oh, and one of them just happened to tell someone who wasn't in the know, and then exactly. They told someone else, and yeah. We've no idea where it came from. We end up with quite a few of these sort of myths, don't we?
Yeah, so the other one is shortened the war by 2 years. And the other half of that is saved millions of lives. Well, you can't quantify millions of lives that might have been saved. That's just imagination. But the first half is based on a statement by Harry Hinsley, who was here in the war and wrote the official history of British intelligence in the war. So he knows what he's talking about, but he admitted that his calculation, the way he came up with this two-year figure, didn't take two really important things into account: the Eastern Front, which I believe David talked about in the podcast about Barbarossa, and also nuclear weapons. And he reasoned that without Ultra, the Allies wouldn't have won the Battle of the Atlantic in 1943. It would have taken longer, so it would have delayed D-Day, and that would have delayed the ending of the war. But he didn't factor in all of the events going on.
So we have Harry Hinsley to thank for shortening the war by 2 years, but we have no idea about the golden eggs at all. No source material. Not able to track down the earliest time it appears.
If anyone can tell us, we'd love to hear.
Absolutely. Please do let us know the earliest time anybody's seen this mention. Our next question is, what was the percentage of foreign staff at Bletchley? And the question is particularly interested in, were there any checks? David?
Well, the short answer to this, a little like Tom's answer to this previous question, is there weren't any, certainly checks, as far as we know. The diplomatic section of Bletchley was working on check codes, but as far as we can tell, the few people that we know about who are in that section all have Anglo-Saxon-sounding names, so it doesn't appear that there are any checks in particular. There were a few Europeans among the population at Bletchley in the latter part of the war, but certainly in the early days, it's very difficult to get a job at Bletchley if you're not British.
So what were the rules about it then?
Well, the rules go back to the founding of GCNCS back in 1919, and they stayed pretty much the same up until 1939. Under those rules, you had to be British between the ages of 21 and 25, and what they called a natural-born British subject, or you could be from the self-governing dominions. And the self-governing dominions is a bit of a euphemism because it refers to Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa, which also were commonly known as the white dominions. Basically, they're the bits of the empire that had very large European populations. So basically, you need to be white and British to join GCNCS. But not only that, both your parents have to be British. And they were really strict on these rules. If you look at the admissions papers for certain individuals who were not recruited in the 1920s and 30s, there's one chap who, although he was 21 when he was interviewed, he wasn't 21 on the 1st of January of that year. So that excluded him. They were absolutely rigorous.
That's harsh.
And there was somebody else who they found out his father, although carrying a British passport, was actually a naturalised Armenian. So they said, no, he couldn't come in either. So they're very, very rigorous about it. And this was partly inherited from the Foreign Office, who had a very similar kind of recruiting stance.
You've said up until 1939, did it change once war had started?
Not straight away, but it does change over the first couple of years of the war. A fairly obvious fact is that if you're looking for people who have particular skills, certainly languages, for example, finding people who have lived in those countries helps, and often those people are from those countries. And particularly in the 1930s, there'd been a big influx into the UK of emigres, refugees, people who were trying to get out of Europe, not only from Nazi Germany, but from Bolshevik Russia, from Spain, from all sorts of places. So there is a pool of people available.
Who speak the languages that GCNCS is interested in understanding.
Yes, so you've got people who speak Russian, people who speak German, people who speak Eastern European languages. Bletchley starts to make exceptions for some of these people. Rolf Nosquith is a famous example. His family had come to the UK in 1932 when he was in his early teens. And he had initially been thought about as for working at Bletchley. But he was turned down on the grounds that his family were Polish and German. But latterly, in 1941, it became apparent that he was both fluent in German and had a degree in maths from Trinity College, Cambridge. So he was in many ways an ideal
recruit, quite a desirable guy.
And he was taken on and worked very successfully at Bletchley for the rest of the war. He then went to settle in Northern Ireland, and he's a very famous individual in Northern Ireland because many people will have heard of the Charnos stockings and underwear line. Mm-hmm. The Nos part of Charnos is Nosquith.
Oh.
And he went on to run their operations in Northern Ireland. They had a big factory over there. And do a lot of philanthropic work in Northern Ireland. So he's very well known over there, as well as being known for Bletchley Park.
Are there any other big names of codebreakers that we might recognise?
There are other individuals who crop up. And one particular group who you can sort of, you can group together are the Jewish personnel who came. Because again, many of these people have roots in Europe and in Eastern Europe and Germany. And so they had all sorts of relevant skills. There's a chap called Martin Sugarman who did a study of Jewish personnel at Bletchley a few years back now. And he identified something like 85 apparently Jewish personnel at Bletchley. And if you do the maths, that works out at about 1% of the workforce. And the Jewish population of the UK at that time was about 0.4% of the population as a whole. So if Jewish people had been recruited just in relationship to their presence in the population, you would have ended up with about 40. The fact they end up with about 80 shows that there was a slight preference towards them because of their skill sets. And there are a particular number of individuals in that group who stand out. Max Newman, who ran the Newmanry, where the Colossus machines were operated from, and who did all his work on fish. Walter Ettinghausen is another one who, as Walter Eitan, he went on to be foreign minister in Israel after the war and a big figure in post-war Israel. So there's a number of these individuals who get taken on in the latter part of the war. Whether the rules are actually officially struck out, I don't know, but there's certainly a lot of blind eyes being turned to people's backgrounds because they're useful people.
And this Martin Sugarman study, some information about that is online, isn't it? People can choose the search engine of choice and put information in.
If you go to the jewishvirtuallibrary.org, his study is on there and he biographizes a number of the people in there. It's a very interesting read.
What about any other nationalities?
There are a couple of other nationalities that can be identified because there were more than one or two of them, if you like. There was a more substantial group. The first are the French, and Tom talked about these in our podcasts a couple of months back about the campaign in France and the Low Countries, and there was a whole team of French personnel who came over at that point and carried on working in Bletchley Park until 1942. A group that a lot of people expected to have come to Bletchley Park but didn't are the Polish codebreakers. We've talked about their successes in Poland in 1939, and they escape via Romania and come to the UK. But quite surprisingly, none of them end up at Bletchley Park. A number of them go to work for the Polish government in exile, and they do cryptographic work with the Polish government in exile. It may seem surprising, but actually, by the time a couple of them were sort of potentially available to come to Bletchley, many of the people who they would have known who they'd been working with in 1939 are no longer here. So Denniston has moved to London to the diplomatic section in 1942. Dilly Knox died in early 43.
But he's too ill to work
for a lot of 1942. Turing, again, is less and less of a figure at Bletchley by that period. So it's quite conceivable that they would not have had sort of immediate contacts to bring them here. The last group that is worth mentioning, who we have talked about at some length in our various podcasts, is, of course, the Americans. And after the agreement in 1943, you get, I can't remember, Tom, do you know how many? Is 150, 200, something?
It's something like 150, yeah.
Yeah, there's about 150 personnel who come, and they are spread throughout the various bits of the GCNCS operation. So you get some in Hut 6, some in Hut 3, some in Sixter. Don't think you get any in naval section, do you?
There are some naval personnel who come over separately, because there's obviously the US Army codebreaking and naval codebreaking are very separate and actual rivals a lot of the time. So the Navy send their own contingent, and I think they go into the naval section.
That's a separate contingent, that's right. And they all live up in Little Brick Hill in the manor house there, which sadly no longer exists.
Don't we have a podcast called Over Here, I think, which features stories about the Americans?
Yeah, we do.
And of course, you have the US Army groups at Eastcote and in the Y Station.
Bexley.
In Bexley, exactly.
Yes. Talking of Americans, one of the people who isn't British enough to join Bletchley initially, but gets in subsequently, is Leonard Hooper, who was turned down initially because his father was American. But he went on to head the Italian air section and then latterly the Japanese air section. So a big player in later war codebreaking.
Is this Joe Hooper who became director of GCHQ?
It's his brother, isn't it?
No, it's the same guy.
Is it the same guy?
Yeah. Leonard Joe Hooper.
Joe Hooper. Oh, I stand corrected.
So yeah, what an opportunity that would have been if they'd missed him. But thankfully he got in, didn't he? By special dispensation from Lord Halifax, I think. I recall reading.
I suppose nobody pointed out that the Prime Minister had an American passport and an American mother. Was it his mother? Was
his mother? Yeah, it's his mother.
Yeah, you can all come, but the Prime Minister can't because he's too foreign.
We have received a question about horology.
What?
Horology.
Horology, right.
We've been asked, what timekeeping mechanisms did the codebreakers use? Was there a central timekeeping mechanism? And how did they compare, for example, between Bletchley Park time and the generals at the front, or Bletchley Park time and German time, and so on? And Tom, I believe you've been looking into this.
Yes.
And this just is a second, Tom.
Oh, hang on a minute. Sorry.
Carry on.
Sorry, you put me right off now.
As you were.
I'm sorry.
Actually, it's surprisingly interesting.
Go on, convince us.
Actually, it is surprisingly interesting. So, if you look at some of the ultra that came out of Bletchley Park, and you can do this by going online, going to the National Archives website, and look in the series Defi Free, you can find all of the ultra messages that were sent out to commanders, and you can download them as a PDF and read them, and they're quite interesting. They're quite difficult to understand if you don't understand all the technicalities of it, and one of the things that's tricky is the timing on them. You will get a timing on those messages as they were teleprinted either to London, to one of the ministries, or to the government, or to the Admiralty, for example, or to Warden Hall, where they were sent out by wireless to commanders in the field. And the time on those messages is the time that they were sent out from Bletchley. But if you look at, in our archives, at what we call our headlines, so these were a version of a particularly important message, which was put to the top of the pile, so to speak, and fast-tracked, then you'll have other timings on it. And one of those is called TOO, time of origin, and one of them is TOI, time of intercept. The time of origin is when the German officer actually handed the message to his cipher clerk to encipher it. So that shows where the message came about. And that would be sort of prepended to the message. So that would be consistent with all the versions. Time of intercept is self-explanatory, really. When did the Allied intercept operator hear the message? And on top of making sure the message is recorded accurately, the interceptor has also got to make sure they get the timing right or record the right time, because that can be very important information later on. The difference between the time of origin and the time of intercept is normally about half an hour, maybe even a couple of hours or even longer, depending on how long the message is, how long it took the cipher clerks to encipher it and then get it on the airwaves. If they're having a very busy day, they might have a few messages queued up. And if they're in a very intense situation, they might fast track it. So you can look at that timing. And if it's a very short time for quite a long message, you can work out that they were actually working flat out to get that message onto the airwaves as quickly as possible.
You're kind of right. This is quite interesting. You kind of imagine the activity happening.
Yeah, and so you can start to recreate the process. Mm-hmm. But of course, understanding that process is obviously important for Bletchley.
Mm-hmm. Have you had to get to grips with this as a researcher about the different times used and what's written on different documents? And
yeah, so
on?
I've got to try and remember which of those is which, because mm-hmm. that can change how you interpret a piece of paper. There's another thing as well with the time zones. So when we did our D-Day takeover, where we put the messages out 75 years after they went onto the airwaves, that was quite confusing because we had to account for the different time zones. And during the war, Britain kept all its clocks an hour ahead. So effectively, it was on summertime all of the time, even in the winter. In the summertime, it went on to GMT plus two, double British summertime. And that carried on to 1947. And that meant they saved energy. It was good for war industry. And it meant that the time in the UK was in time with Central European time, as used by the Germans. But the British military always uses what they call Zulu time, which is just GMT plus or minus nothing.
Do the British military still use Zulu time?
They do. That is useful for military operations because it never changes. That's obviously used by the intercept operators who are military. And that meant that when they were taking down the messages, they weren't accounting for summertime at all. And we had to remember that. So that means that when you see, sometimes you see a time of intercept that's earlier than the time of origin, because the Germans are working 2 hours ahead of the British. And then you have to get the German time and move it 2 hours back in your head. And then you work out how long it actually took for that message to go on the airwaves. And another problem when we were doing D-Day was that the history books tend to use GMT plus one or GMT plus two, but they're a bit inconsistent. So trying to match up a message to a historical event in the battle was a bit tricky at times.
You find this with a few, quite often the start of the invasion of Poland or start of Barbarossa, you get different times, don't you? You know, you get these dramatic descriptions of 5:20 a.m. And it turns out it was an hour earlier. This must happen all the way through everything we look into.
Well, the most spectacular we'll come to in December.
Yes.
Which is the fact that Malaya is invaded on the 8th of December before Pearl Harbor is attacked on the 7th of December because of the international dateline. But that's a complexity we can save for
that's
later.
That's what even I can't get my head around that one.
One of the things that's to pick up on what Tom was saying about the difference between time of origin and time of intercept, and then this time that the message is transmitted to the customer, whoever it may be. I've been doing a lot of work on naval enigma, and there you have to look at these times very, very carefully, because the way the Germans used naval enigma meant that it went in essentially 48-hour cycles, because they change half the key every 12 hours. So they change some of the settings every 2 days and some of the settings every day. And what that means is Bletchley will be intercepting traffic from, and they changed it at midday rather than midnight. So it's 12 noon when the key change happens. And so from 12 noon, the Y stations will start picking up messages from U-boats. And quite often, those messages won't start being broken for some hours because the Bletchley needs to run a bomb cycle and get a crib and a menu and do all the things they need to break the daily key. But once they've broken the daily key, they can process all the messages quite quickly. So what you see is a consistent flow of messages from the Germans, if you like, with times of intercept over the whole 24-hour period. And then suddenly you'll get a clump of teleprinter transmission times from Bletchley to the Admiralty when they've actually managed to break the messages. And you'll get a sudden burst of traffic sent from Bletchley Park to the Admiralty. And then it'll go silent again until sort of the next key cycle comes around.
Whilst they're working it all out.
And it's very important when you're looking at some of the convoy battles, one I've been looking at recently, that the Germans are discussing, they're being ordered to find the convoy, they're reporting that they've found it, all of these sorts of things. And all of those messages are being intercepted. But actually, the Admiralty doesn't know that because it takes more than 12 hours in some cases for those messages actually to be broken. And then once they have broken them, if a message in the 24-hour period comes in after they've already got the key out, or after they've already broken the key, then that message can be turned around in an hour. And so you can't just look at when the Germans sent a message and say, oh, that's when the Allies knew about it. You have to factor in this variable cycle of time for the breaking. And we talk a sort of shorthand, we say on D-Day, they could break some of these messages in as little as sort of 2.5 hours. That's the fastest. The longest can be 2.5 weeks, because with the vagaries of the keys and the breaking processes and things, the gap between intercepting a message and being able to send a decrypted translation of it to somebody important is a hugely flexible, how long is a piece of string period. And it's very rarely minutes. It can be hours, but it can equally be days. So these times that appear on these messages, they sound like trivia, but they're actually really, really important in understanding how this stuff works and why it's significant or not significant in the battlefield. And it's that cycle about making, certainly the operationally urgent stuff, about that cycle about making it available quickly enough for it to be useful, that's really important.
And obviously, it's all a question of priorities as well. What does your customer need to hear now? What can they hear tomorrow if it needs to take that long? That whole process of prioritizing is another really interesting one that has to happen at Bletchley to make the whole thing work.
And the other thing they do as part of trying to make this as efficient as possible is they do what would now be called time and motion studies. They spend a lot of time standing behind people with stopwatches, finding out how long each of the processes in a decryption cycle takes. And they catalogue huge amounts of statistics about how long the bombs take to work through menus and how many bomb machines it takes to break a particular crib and all of this. And they're compiling all these statistics so that they can then refine the process. And what they do is they say, right, that whole job took an hour, but this one part of it took 45 minutes. So we need to get, if we can get that bit shorter, obviously it'll make a big impact on the whole job. Whereas this task only took 2 minutes, so we don't really need to worry about it.
You don't sort of think about that, do you? People evaluating the code breaking process, sort of standing back with a clipboard.
Oh, yeah.
Watching them.
And it's really kind of 1930s, 40s thing as well. That sort of cheaper by the dozen kind of time and motion thing was very much a fashion at the time anyway. A lot of the data we have now, because we get so often asked how many messages were sent, you know, how many were intercepted, how many were broken, you know, all of this to try and encapsulate how much work Bletchley did. The reason most of those numbers exist in the archives in the first place is because they were trying to make the system more efficient and they were timing themselves and measuring themselves all the time.
I have a horological follow-up for Tom about why was timekeeping at Bletchley an important question about the actual mechanism?
Okay, so on the one hand, Bletchley need to understand these times, as I was saying before, to help them do their work. And a really good example of this is when they're looking for re-encodements or retransmissions of the same message. Sometimes you need to pick a message twice to get a good version of it that you can break. And sometimes the Germans will re-encrypt a message on a different key. And if you've broken it on one key, then that gives you a crib for a second key. And you can spot those through traffic analysis. If you get the timings right, you can see a message arrives at a station and then another one goes out again of the same length or maybe with the same discriminant on it. And you can say that's probably the same message. We should try and use a crib on that key and see if we can break it, for example.
Oh, so that could have been another on a different Enigma network then, maybe.
Yeah, a completely different Enigma network.
So you've broken two with the same message, yeah.
Yeah, potentially. It gives you a really important way in. And this is a really important service that the traffic analysts give to HUT6. This work is not just for finding out intelligence, but just for finding who's talking to whom and where they are and how the German army is organized, although they get that out of it as well, but it's also giving them ways into their cryptographic systems. So you have that side of it, and you also have the internal, as David was saying, managing the process and managing the efficiency of the process and trying to fine-tune it. I found some really interesting testimony in the archives from Phoebe Senyard.
Phoebe Senyard of Naval Section said, "We had to be constantly on the alert for the inexcusable delays between our room and the main teleprinter room. If anyone noted, we had to report them to the supervisor of the main TP room immediately by telephone, giving the number of the teleprint or the machine number."
They're being co-opted into these. It's not just someone standing behind you with a clipboard. It's the staff are being asked to report back. And from 1943, Senyard tells us they actually had a timekeeping clock in the office. And this was how, you asked in the question, was there any central timekeeping? This is how that was all organised.
She said, "We had to ring the telephone exchange and ask for time in order to check the time. We're not allowed to tamper with the clock, but had to ring an extension and a mechanic was sent to alter it."
Yeah, I've got the memo here to prove it. So yeah, there was a central office, we think it was in the mansion, which coordinated the timekeeping for the whole site. And many officers had these time stamping machines and you would put the piece of paper in and the jaws would come down and like a punch and stamp the time on, and you would get a sort of digital time, or you would actually get a little picture of a clock with hands on it, which is kind of cute.
That is. Wow.
Many of the pieces of paper in the archive have these on them. They have signatures on and stamps saying they've been in a particular section, and they were just used to track a piece of paper around the site. The idea was that you could pick a piece of paper out of a pile and work out where it had been and how long it had taken to move through the process, and that's all part of that efficiency drive. And that was important, actually, because they're always short on space, they're always short on personnel, but there are some inefficiencies which are unavoidable. So the best example of this is when they're sending material out from Hut 3 to Wadden, sending overseas, they need to encipher it first. And one of the ways they do that is with the Typex machine. And the Typex machines, because they're big and bulky and they need to encipher a lot of messages, they're not actually held in Hut 3. They're in the cipher office, which is in a completely different building over the road. So they have a conveyor that goes over the road into the other building, and then it has to be passed to the right person, and then they have to encipher the message, and they have to go all the way back again to Hut 3 to their teleprinter room, which is in-house, and then they can send it. And as it says in the history of Hut 3, that adds all this extra paperwork, and you need all the people to run the system, but they just don't have the space on the site to organise it any other way.
So stuff going out from Bletchley Park didn't have this timestamp on it, did it? Or did everything get timestamped just before it left? How on earth can you tell?
Yeah, so as stuff was teleprinted out of the park, it would have you would get a time on the teleprint.
Mm-hmm, right.
And we see those in the archives.
This reminds me of a point in the history of Japanese codebreaking in Hut 7 and in Block A. I think it's in Hugh Foss's report where he describes in Naval Section 1J, they were all working under tremendous pressure, but they felt they were making a lot of progress. So everyone was working way longer than their shifts and everything else and putting in all the hours God sent. And he describes getting a questionnaire from the management, and it had all these different personnel questions, and it had, please use this space to report incidents of tardiness and people turning up late for their shifts and all this sort of thing. And he said he took great pleasure in just writing none in the box and sending it back. It was like, no, my people all turn up because they care about what they're doing, which wasn't the case across the whole park. But certainly he felt that the team he had, that some of this, can you check that no one's been bunking off early businesses?
John's worth three.
You clearly haven't been watching what we're doing here because nobody's bunked off early in the last 3.5 years. But it's quite nice to see.
We have spoken far more and in far more interesting terms about timekeeping than I thought we would, actually. You were not wrong. It is quite an interesting subject.
We could have gone on for hours.
Oh, yeah. There was one last thing I wanted to mention.
And one more thing.
There's one last aspect of timing, which is how do you indicate this to the recipient? How do you let them know if the information they're getting is current or if it's a few days old? Mm-hmm. Or does it refer to something in the future? So they have to factor this in. And when they're drawing up a message, they always do it in the pretense that it's an agent's report. And this is maintained throughout the war, in the case of Army Air Enigma, at least, not with Naval Enigma so much. Even though most of the customers by late war know that this is from broken codes, just in case it falls into the wrong hands, they still draw it up as if, an agent has found a scrap of paper in the waste paper basket of the commander of such and such army. So they come up with conventions to describe the time. And they would actually indicate the time of origin or the time of intercept, whichever was more relevant in the body of the message, and say, on such and such date, this was reported. And where the timing of the message isn't important, but because it refers to something which is yet to happen, then it would simply say, on this date, this is what's going to happen.
In prose.
But in that case, it's not necessary to say when it was found out, you see. It's only necessary to tell the customer when it will happen.
Would either of you like any more time to talk about the history of timekeeping? Our next question. Did the British have an equivalent to the Enigma machine? David?
I can go one better than that. The British had an Enigma machine.
An actual Enigma
machine. Well, they had two. One of the misconceptions about Enigma is that it was this very secret thing that only the German military had, and, you know, examples had to be captured at the beginning of the war and all of this. Actually, as we've talked about in our previous podcast about breaking Enigma, we talked about the history of the machine. And the glow lamp version, the one that we're familiar with in the Second World War, was invented in the early 1920s. And actually, Edward Travis from GCNCS went to, I think it was Vienna, in 1926 and bought two of them on the commercial market because they were available for banks and building societies and all that sort of thing. So he bought two of the machines and brought them back to the UK, and they were analysed by Hugh Foss, who wrote a description both of how the machine functioned, but also his theory about how the machine could be broken. And this is the early machine that doesn't have a plug board on it, so it's simpler than a wartime machine. But partly on the basis of Foss's analysis, the British government look at the machine and go, we probably don't want to buy this for our own use. We don't think it's very good. Sherbius had actually taken out patents in the UK so that he could earn money from having it manufactured in the UK if the British government bought it, but they chose not to.
Fun fact, you can actually find some of these patent diagrams online now, as I'm steering people towards the internet anyway to look things up. You can find early Enigma patents in various countries.
So would they have been in the country's patent offices then?
Yes.
Yes.
For the commercial version, not for the military version.
Right, but that would have given you some pointers, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is what I'm saying. The idea that the functioning of the machine is a secret is not really the case. Certain parts of the machine are secret. The individual wiring of the rotors is secret. Yeah. And, of course, the plug board provides a whole lot of extra security for the system anyway. And, obviously, your keys have to be secret. But there's a document from 1934, which Frodevire, the Enigma scholar that we know very well, found. And that lists countries that had bought Enigma machines at that period.
You listed it in Enigma and Lot, didn't you? You went through the list, yeah.
Yeah, I've got it here again. Afghanistan, USA, Argentina, Chile, Germany, UK, France, the Netherlands, Italy, Mexico, Austria, Poland, Russia, Sweden, Czechoslovakia and Hungary all had Enigma machines in 1934.
Where's this list from then?
It's from the archives of the manufacturing company in Germany, which Frodo has tracked down.
So when Edward Travis went to buy his Enigmas, it was all in the open?
Oh, yes.
It was recorded
on the list it says England, I think, too.
All right.
So you can see it's the same two machines.
So he wasn't even worried about concealing it?
No, no. And this goes back to, again, something I speak about fairly regularly, which is this idea of Kirchhoff's principle, which is the idea that it's not the machine itself or the cipher system that needs to be secret. It's the individual key or the individual setting of the machine that you keep secret. And that's where the secrecy lies. And that's exactly the same with modern encryption systems. Everyone knows how the system works, but you have your own key of whatever complexity that provides the security.
It makes me think of that scene in The Imitation Game where Charles Dance, playing the role of Commander Denniston, says, "Gentlemen, meet Enigma." And I'm wondering how the film would have gone if they went, "No, we've already met, actually."
Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah.
Have you read my report on it, boss? I mean, the Germans are doing things with Enigma that make it more complicated, and they are also the critical bits, the wiring of the rotors and things like that, they do keep secret. So it's not as if you could just buy one and start reading people's messages. You couldn't. But it was out there.
The Poles help us with the actual wiring in the rotors, don't they?
Yes.
If we haven't got anywhere with that.
Rejewski figures out the wiring of the rotors and famously the wiring of the entry wheel, which so upsets
Dilly Knox, isn't it?
in his taxi. But the other thing is, at that period, and especially towards the end of the 1930s, Enigma is not the only option out there. There are a family of different Enigma machines that Sherbius develops and are developed after his death. But also there are all sorts of other machines out there which work on a similar rotary-based principle.
Rotaries were all the rage.
Rotaries were all the rage. And having them only used by one country is, in some cases, quite unusual. I mean, if we look at the machines that Boris Hagelin developed, the Hagelin C series, which is the C-36 and the C-38, which is the Italians used, both the French and the USA used versions, almost identical versions of that machine. The M-209, which is the American version, from which Hagelin made all his money because he sold something like 40,000 of them to the Americans. Those machines are functionally very similar, but actually being used by people on opposite sides of the Second World War. But again, it's how you use the machine and what keys you use, what settings you use on the machine to make some secret. So all this is kind of out there in the ether. But the short answer to the question is Enigma itself was not adopted by the British for any practical purposes.
So my fairly obvious next question is, if they did not use Enigma and rotary machines were all the rage, and it makes sense that that's the level of difficulty of encryption, then what were the British using?
Well, they set about developing their own machine, which they hope will be better. And actually, this was initially an initiative of the Air Force, the Air Ministry. And there's a chap called Wing Commander Lywood, who produced a machine called Type-X.
Which is T-Y-P-E-X, one
word. The word type with the letter X at the end. And people argue about whether the X should be capital and the rest of the word lowercase, but no one cares.
Was there a Type Y?
No. Type-X is the machine. One word.
It does, of course, set a trend for British cipher machines to have EX on the end. So you get the Rock X, and a few others, more obscure ones that follow the same sort of naming principle.
But Lywood came up with a machine initially for the RAF and the Air Ministry in 1934. It's very similar to an Enigma. It has rotors that move. It has poles that push the rotors around in a similar manner to Enigma. And so the encryption function is very similar. It has, in the early models, 5 rotors instead of 3. But actually, only 3 of them move. The other 2 are static. You can position them before you start encrypting, but they will never move in the course of the encryption. But actually, if you think about it, because of the number of turnovers you'd need to get to the 4th and 5th wheels, having a mechanism to make them turn over
the longest
you'd have to send the longest messages in the world to make it work. One of the interesting things we were talking about, Sherbius registering his patents in the UK earlier because he hoped to sell machines here. The Air Ministry is initially quite concerned about putting Typex into full production because they're worried that they'll get sued because it's sufficiently similar to Enigma. Eventually, they decide that they're going to keep it a secret anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, so what? And they don't get sued. There is a bit of a legal discussion about whether it's sufficiently different from Enigma. So a prototype was produced in 1935, and the machine was started to be rolled out in 1937. As I say, it's potentially more secure than Enigma, and it's actually more convenient to use because most models of Typex print out the text for you on a paper tape. On an Enigma, you've got to press the key and hold it down, and a light bulb comes on under a letter, and either you or your assistant has to then write down that letter manually, and then you press another key, and the next light comes on. It's all a bit of a faff. With Typex, you can type away at normal speed, and the machine encrypts the letters and prints out the encrypted text on a strip of paper. And equally, you can type in ciphertext, and it will print it out in plain text on a strip of paper. Sometimes it will do both at the same time if you wanted to. It will print you both. So it's easier to operate and potentially more secure. But it's massively bigger. It's a big, bulky thing.
But Typex is more closely related to Enigma than that, though, surely?
It is, because it was sufficiently similar to the German machine that it was relatively easy to modify a British-built Typex just by rewiring the rotors, for example, to make it function the same as a German Enigma machine. And what that meant at Bletchley was, once the code-breaking process was complete, the key finding process was complete, and they had a daily key. They then obviously had a pile of messages that would use that key, which they needed to decipher.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you had a Typex machine that was adapted to function like an Enigma machine, you could simply give those intercepts to an operator and they would set up their Typex machine in the same fashion as the opposing Enigma, type in all the messages, and out on the paper strip would come the plain text German.
So British manufactured fakey Enigma machine.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
So that's one of its uses. Interestingly, I've tried to look into who actually came up with this idea and when the first ones were introduced, but I haven't got very far yet. And I spoke to GCHQ and they didn't know either.
I was going to say, were they tight-lipped about it at all?
They weren't tight-lipped about it. They were just a little bit, oh no, we haven't really thought about that either. So who knows? It's used for two purposes at Bletchley Park. One is for the decryption of German messages once the keys are known,
mm-hmm.
but it's also used, as Tom was describing, for the re-encryption of messages if they need to be transmitted by any sort of insecure means outside Bletchley. Stuff that's not being teleprinted to a ministry in London, so stuff that's going out to Wadden and being put on the airwaves for Montgomery in France or whatever, has to be re-encrypted, so they use Typex for that. One of the other modifications that occurs later in the war is a thing called the Combined Cipher Machine, the CCM. And this comes about because with the code-breaking sharing between the UK and the USA, particularly in the field of the Japanese, the two sides need to exchange a lot of material. The Americans are intercepting messages, the British are intercepting messages. They're also developing additive tables for the various Japanese systems. So there's huge amounts of data that has to be swapped between the two code-breaking organizations. But neither wants to give the other its own cipher machine. The British didn't want the Americans to have a Typex machine because they're worried that they'd analyze it and then they'd be able to potentially read our traffic. And also the Americans had a rotor-based cipher machine called ECM, or SIGABA is its other name. And so the compromise they reached was they developed a sort of bolt-on attachment to each of those two machines that allowed them to talk to each other. So Typex could talk to ECM and ECM could talk to Typex, even though they weren't the same. And that's what's used for all of this transmission of shared information in the second half of the war, particularly in the Far East. It's a bit of an annoyance to the Americans because a lot of this material they're circulating around through their own stations in Australia and Hawaii and places using their standard ECM cipher machine. And all the stuff they've got to share with the British, they have to re-encrypt with this other machine. So they're a bit reluctant to do it. But it does provide a link, a secure link between the two countries. And that's one of the other modifications of Typex that happens.
We know that the British were going onto U-boats and pinching Enigma machines. Did the Germans ever manage to pinch a Typex?
They did. Several were captured. We know that one at least was captured after Dunkirk was left behind in France. The rotors were taken out of it by the operator, so they just got the sort of carcass of the machine. Another one was also captured later in North Africa. And there was a German project to investigate the machine to try and figure out how it worked. They didn't get very far. In the late 1941, they basically gave up because it became apparent that without the rotors, the task was going to be more or less impossible. There was also a bit of, I suppose you call it intellectual snobbery, that the more they examined it and the more it looked like an Enigma machine, the more they were inclined to believe it was unbreakable. Because had they been able to successfully break Typex, to any intelligent person, they would be able to go, well, if you can break Typex, surely you can break Enigma. So they were kind of predisposed to think they couldn't do it, but they certainly had a go. And what's quite interesting about the report they made was that many of the operator errors that GCNCS exploited with German Enigma, predictable settings and cribs from predictable message text and other bad habits, British wireless operators and cipher operators were just as bad at those mistakes as the Germans were. So all of the human factors. It's quite easy to get a bit smug at Bletchley and go, oh, the Germans made all these foolish errors in their communications. Actually, it becomes clear that the British were making exactly the same errors in their communications. And there's also a kind of indirect consequence of Typex is because it was quite a large and elaborate machine and the manufacturing process was quite slow, there were never enough Typexes to go around. And a particular area where there's a shortage is in the Navy. In an ideal world, they would have put one of these machines on every ship. And by the 1950s, the Royal Navy has one on every ship. But for the first part of the war, only kind of battleships and above get a Typex machine. All of the other ships have to work on book codes. And we've talked elsewhere about how badly compromised those book codes were. The Germans were reading Royal Navy book codes right up to 1943. So the fact that the Germans are able to read naval code books is partly a consequence of the fact that there weren't enough Typexes to replace them. So the complexity and cost of the machine works against us in that way.
You said that in the 1950s, they were on a whole lot of British ships. So they're still in use in the 1950s. Were they still using Typex in the 60s? Are they still out there?
They continued in widespread use after the war. But by the time you get to the early 1960s, more electronic-based systems are coming in. And they were phased out by the UK. Some of our allies, the Canadians, the Australians, used them a little bit longer, but not much. So by the mid-60s, they've mostly been retired. But despite that, they've remained secret for quite a long time. There's a few of them out there. They're probably harder to find than Enigma machines, I'd say, nowadays, actually. There's not that many of them in collections. And, you know, you can't find them on eBay the way you can with some other cipher machines. So there may be a warehouse full of them somewhere, I don't know. But
keep your eagle eyes out, listeners.
Yes.
Our next question for you, Tom, is were there any women in charge at Bletchley Park, or did they all have lower status jobs like we're led to believe?
The short answer is, even though some women were, of course, very successful at Bletchley Park, mostly they're excluded from official positions of responsibility due to the social situation of the 1940s. Let me go through some examples of women who make really important contributions. The first on my list is Emily Anderson. She was a codebreaker in the First World War in the Army Codebreaking Department of MI1B, and she was founder member of GCNCS. She's head of a subsection in the diplomatic section before the war, and one of the things she does there, which you know about, is training Wilfred Bodsworth, who actually goes on to be raised to a higher position than her and goes on to be a senior manager in naval section and head of the Italian part of naval section and later the German part. And Anderson went to the Middle East in 1940 and she was actually appointed OBE in 1943, but she was never head of the section, even though she had vast experience of doing what she did. Another one is Rhoda Welsford. She's another First World War codebreaker. She came into Air Section, and she was responsible for a lot of the work to reconstruct what they called the Bird Book, which is the German B call sign book. And by listening into transmissions, the British reconstructed that from scratch before capturing a copy in the North African desert and finding out that they got it pretty much spot on. And she was in charge of the Bird Book, and she was known to use it as a projectile weapon against those who angered her.
It's not just impressive for actually working on the book, but also for whacking at people's heads.
Formidable, I think, is the term, but I think there's a cliche here of a sort of formidable, spinsterish sort of woman who's got nothing apart from her work and is very proud of it, and it's a bit difficult to work with, and I don't know, I suppose the term would be shrill. I think there's a bit of a sexist narrative there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it'd be femme formidable, wouldn't it, in French? But I don't think it's quite so derisory in French, is it? The way that we look at that.
It's kind of used to damn with faint praise in English, isn't it, in a way? That
it is a bit. And I think it's a lot of the women in this story are stereotyped in that way. And I
sort of blue stocking kind of way.
Yes, they can only be good at their jobs at the expense of other aspects of their character.
Yeah.
This seems to be the implication.
I'm going
to
get angry at this.
Of course, these women are all misses because when they get married, they have to leave their jobs.
Right.
So it is in a way that's inevitable. But I don't want to stereotype them too much, is just what I'm saying.
History's done that for you, Tom, don't worry. So if you can put a bit of honesty back into the story, that's fantastic.
And during the war, of course, there are other women that come into the organisation and make big contributions. One of them is Margaret Rock. She works on Abwehr, on German intelligence codes in ISK. She's at the forefront of that section, and Dilly Knox actually positions for her pay to be raised because he says she's not getting the recognition and the reward she deserves. And in our GCHQ exhibition, we have on display a manuscript which she worked on along with Mavis Beatty, her husband Keith Beatty, and Peter Twin on all of the work of ISK during the war. And she obviously works at GCHQ after the war as well. So Margaret Rock is a really important codebreaker, but she never receives equal pay to her male colleagues, and she never receives a position of actual responsibility in an official capacity. And the exception that proves the rule here is Joan Clark, who is Turing's sometime fiance and colleague in Hut 8, and is deputy head of that section after Turing leaves and Hugh Alexander takes over, and is well known for being, again, the head of a field in that section, but isn't the head of the section, and even getting to deputy head is pretty exceptional, and it takes someone of the calibre of Joan Clark to break through the glass ceiling even to that extent. But there are so many other women who work at Bletchley and never receive any of the credit they really deserve at all, that they would have done if the organisation was really meritocratic.
So you're saying some of these women were in charge, but not in name, in action, in activity, in what they were doing to some extent, or?
As near as damn it, I think, isn't it?
I mean, it's hard to know exactly how these sections worked because a lot of that stuff isn't written down, but you can obviously imagine that people of that calibre, they must have been in a sort of leadership role in terms of organising the work,
mm-hmm.
but they weren't getting official recognition. They weren't getting the posts and the titles and the higher pay that was routine for the leading male cryptanalysts. And there was basically also a complete bar on women taking positions of responsibility over men, with that possibly sole exception of Joan Clark, very few others.
Was that a GCNCS only thing, or is this kind of the standard culturally across the board?
Well, no, I think we can't say GCNCS was being too old-fashioned here. It was the 1940s.
Yeah.
They were actually remarkably forward-thinking in some ways, but I suppose from our point of view, it looks like a conflicted picture.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think when I first started working in the 1980s even, that having a woman in charge of you or in charge of a department, even then was still quite unusual, I think. So back in the 1940s, it would have been nearly unheard of, wouldn't it?
Yeah. To be fair, on the other side of the scales, we do have some examples of women taking sort of positions of leadership, and that's mostly service women, and where you have these sections where there are large numbers of service women working together, especially in communications and also in bomb operations, there are women who are put in charge of those sections, and they are generally, it seems, put in charge in a meritocratic way.
You do see a lot of women as the next rung down, don't you? That sort of the official management roles, the heads of sections, the heads of subsections are men, but immediately below that, and I'm thinking about in naval section, you have people like Valerie Travis and other people who are the most senior of the people who are actually doing the work. And, you know, the chief of the technical library is a woman. Many of the indexes are run by women. In a practical sense, they're run by women because all of the actual work and the staff of those sections are being managed by that person. The titular head of it will be a man in some sort of management role, but often the chief specialist, if you like, is female. And I think that's quite striking. And a number of those are hired because they have skills, you know, in certain areas.
Yeah, that's just sort of the point they're able to get to before the glass ceiling sort of stops them, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, in these sections with service women, we quite often see references when these women leave the services and go off and they're given a reference, and it doesn't go into, of course, any of the detail of the work. But it gives you an idea of why they were chosen for that role, and they're commended for being sort of committed and focused workers, and especially for remaining upbeat and being able to concentrate even when the work was very monotonous and the hours very long. So they're almost being promoted as a good example to the rest of the workers. But I think there's also a lot of evidence that they also need to have good leadership and management skills to go along with it in order to be raised up into that position.
You know, I don't think I've ever seen a reference written for a man that said he was able to focus despite the work being tedious and boring. I don't know if I've ever seen
it. There is a slightly patronising tone to these as well, and that goes with, it's that fantastic quote out of Nigel de Grey's post-war report where he says, "It's amazing what you can train young women to do." Which just, in that I don't think he was trying to be sexist. It's just, his phrasing just sounds awful. It was incredibly tone deaf to us. But I think he was genuinely...
He does use the actual word slaves at one point as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, there is the word slaves as a synonym for unskilled workers, as a synonym for women, is quite common as well.
Not covering himself in glory, de Grey there. The big cheese is the person right at the top in each of these teams, we're saying, was pretty much always, in fact, it was always men.
Yeah, and in some sections, really, the one-sided kind of gender nature of it goes really too far. It's not even like David said, where women are almost second in command. The men are in charge, the women do the work. And a really good example of this is the cipher office. And we're going to talk about Typex again, because this is the section where all of those Typex machines are encoding and decoding information coming in and out of the park. It's extremely monotonous work. It's physically demanding because of the design of the machine. You have to press the keys very hard and you have to sit almost above the machine in quite an awkward position. And to do that for 8 hours straight is physically demanding.
Health and safety would ban it today.
They definitely would. The section has a sickness rate of 6-7%, which is double any other section at the park. We have a brilliant list in the archive of reasons these women have gone off sick, including things like joint pain, eye strain, and gastric problems, but also a high number of what they called nervous debility, nervous breakdown, anxiety, and psychoneurotic problems. So the strain is getting to the women. And actually, sickness rates are used in military history as an indicator of morale.
Mm.
If you look at an army unit, and I tried to do some very basic analysis of this and came to the conclusion that rates at Bletchley in the cipher office are at least equal to an infantry unit at the front, if not higher. But the management's response to this is really telling, because they mostly blame the problems on the physical conditions. And they say there's not enough ventilation and the work is tough. But
not,
then they also...
It's a toxic office environment or anything like that. It's...
No, the morale doesn't come into it. Or they suggest that the problems were to do with the type of girl they were employing. Type of girl is their phrasing. Because they found it hard to find recruits. They tried to recruit from the local area and mostly failed at that. But managed to tempt a small number of women to come to Bletchley. But they're not able to pay as much as other departments can. So they're always struggling for staff to do this sort of work. And therefore, they have an impression that they get the dregs. And as a result, they don't treat them very well when they're here, ironically. So little thought is given to whether there might actually be a big morale problem here. And then eventually they send the chairwoman of the Women's Committee to go in and spend some time in the section and have a look at what the conditions are like.
Well, I was going to say, I remember when we did an exhibition here off duty, we looked into the welfare of the staff and some of the messaging that we had in that exhibition was about people were quite well looked after, people were recognised as in need of support and so on. And it sounds like this particular section was really struggling, but there was a women's committee.
Yes, that is one of the enlightened things about the organisation, is that they do set up a women's committee and they do have an acknowledgement at the top levels that these workers have, you know, issues which are unique to them and that need to be respected and we need to look after their welfare. But I think the cipher office is a good example of how inconsistently that is applied some of the time. And especially among the workers who are the lowest paid and the least prestigious in the whole park. If you're a cryptanalyst, you're likely to get much better treatment than you are if you're working in the cipher office and you're literally the bottom rung of the ladder. So I've got a quote here from her report. And again, I wondered if you wanted to read that out.
"I found the girls friendly and obviously glad to have someone from outside interested in what they were doing, provided the initiative came from me. I felt a tremendous lack of any kind of personal touch in this large and rather unwieldy section, and I know, with large numbers and everybody very busy, that it must be one of the first things to be overlooked. But at the same time, if there was somebody who was really interested in these girls, I'm sure that morale would improve considerably. It would be a full-time job for the right person, whoever that may be. I do not wish to cast aspersions on the present regime, but at the same time, I feel that probably, because it is rushed and busy, there is no time to give that personal touch to the staff which it requires, particularly as most of it is doing such concentrated and repetitive work and can see so little results for their pains. This is sounding pretty bleak. This was not the experience of every woman at Bletchley Park, was it?
No, I mean, I've picked the worst example here. This is as bad as it gets. And as I said, in some ways, Bletchley is remarkably enlightened when it comes to gender equality. There are opportunities here for women. Some of them excel and are recognised very substantially for it. The ones that go on to work at GCHQ after the war, chief among them. But there are many who gain really important experience here, professional experience, but experience of leadership. And especially for the service women, they take that into civilian life, whatever they do later on. And there are so many women, of course, who go on to do fantastic things later on. So, yeah, it's the 1940s. Bletchley is not as enlightened as maybe the stereotype holds. But for the 1940s, the record isn't a bad one, I would say.
I think the other important point to make here is we are very regularly asked about the women of Bletchley Park because they were such a large proportion of the workforce. And we're asked about them. We're very keen to celebrate their contribution and the role they play. But I often argue that what's remarkable about these women is not that Bletchley Park was a particularly benign place for them to work, but that it wasn't. And that the ones who succeed and the ones who stand out as historical characters in the way they do, it's even more remarkable because they're not necessarily being helped in that process. It's not because Bletchley is especially liberal and they're able to do that. They're doing that despite the conditions of the place and the time, rather than because of.
We've had a question. Which hut at Bletchley Park has been least covered in the books? So which hut is the least well-known or the least acknowledged?
Well, yeah, the most underrated, I would say. I'll start off by saying there's an assumption in that question that a hut is the same as a section. Mm-hmm. We talk about sections at Bletchley that do various things, and actually they're not really direct synonyms. It's not like each section has its hut. Some sections famously took the name of the hut they worked in for sort of internal security reasons. And when they moved, the hut name stuck. So we have hut 6, 3 and 8. But other sections never were in a hut, never got a hut name. Some are named after the person who was in charge or they're named after what they did. So you have sections named after huts, but not working in huts. You have sections working in huts, which aren't named after huts. It's not an enormously helpful term. But if we assume hut means section, what's my favourite underrated section?
Which would you pick?
I would say probably Sixter, which is the traffic analysis section named either Six Intelligence School Traffic Analysis or Hut Six Traffic Analysis. Mm-hmm. We're not quite sure where the name comes from. Possibly both. And this was a vital sort of adjunct to the Hut 3 and 6 sort of complex that was breaking Enigma. And it grew out of the Army Traffic Analysis Department. It begins a war outside of Bletchley. It's in London. Part of it moves to Bow Manor, the big Army Y station in Leicestershire. And part of it comes to Bletchley as it's actually integrated into Hut 3 for a time. The second part actually arrives at Bletchley and goes into Hut 15, A, B, C, and D. There were four Hut 15, so that helps the confusion. But they realise they have to bring these groups together again, so they bring them together in the newly constructed Block G, and soon that is called Sixter. So they have a fantastic traffic analysis department all together. So traffic analysis is all the work you can do based on enemy communications that doesn't involve actually reading the messages. They're looking at who talks to who, looking at when, looking at the timings, of course, looking at patterns of traffic, looking at volumes of traffic. You can often work out if something is going to happen. This is obviously very important in the naval context, that you can work out an operation is about to happen if the traffic explodes. You don't have to actually read the messages. And they feed into the code-breaking process in Hut 6 by looking for those re-encodements and cribs that can give the cryptanalysts a way in, and they feed into the intelligence process because by listening to these wireless nets and building up a picture of what those look like, they
really have a picture of what the German armed forces looks like. And that's something that Huttfree can hang all of the intelligence they're gaining from Enigma on and contextualize it all.
Mm. So these are sort of code breakers with no codes, effectively.
Yeah, they're as integral a part of the code breaking process as the cryptanalysts are. And they're an integral part of the intelligence process, just like the intelligence officers. But they're not quite either of them. They sort of sit outside. And actually, they have their heyday at the end of the war, De Sixter, because later on in the war, the Germans bring in better security procedures. And we often talk about how they broke into Enigma. But of course, once you're in, you have to stay in. And that's a big task on its own. It gets harder and harder as the war goes on. And actually, if the Germans had been as secure in 1940 as they were in 1944, 1945, Bletchley would have never probably broken into Enigma in the first place.
Mm.
They really tighten things up. And one of the ways they do that is to drop all of the telltale discriminants or call signs that tell you who is talking to who. And that's really important because if the Germans are using maybe 50 different Enigma keys and you don't know which message is on which key, you can't possibly break it because it could be enciphered in 50 different ways. In order to make those identifications, the traffic analysts are really important because they are the link between Bletchley also and the Y stations. And at this point, the Y stations also come into their own because they can track these people. They can most famously recognize operators by their fist, by their manner of transmitting Morse, but also by a lot of other features, a lot of other habits the Germans use, which allow them to sort of achieve continuity over the wireless nets they're listening in on. And Sixter then pull all this together, work out what the German networks look like, and then that gives Hut 6 the framework to keep breaking Enigma right up to the end of the war.
You say so German networks, is this the German army or...?
The German army and air force.
Right, so pretty big picture stuff.
Yeah, so that's really important work and it keeps Bletchley Park in the fight right up to the end of the war, up to the point of victory. So that's why I think they're important.
And underrated.
And very underrated.
Am I right in thinking that there's a report about Sixter that's only recently emerged?
The internal history of Sixter, which is an enormous document, yeah, has recently been declassified just a couple of years ago.
Why was it classified for so long? What was so secret about it?
Oh, well, the thing about traffic analysis is that a lot of it remains very relevant today. A lot of the work GCHQ now does directly descends from Bletchley really is traffic analysis because there are so many communications nowadays and they're so well encrypted that you can't read enough of them. And when you do read them, you've got actually too much material for any human being to sift through. So I'm sure they have their ways. I'm sure they have AI algorithms and all of these analytical techniques to work through it, which I have no business knowing about. But traffic analysis is really important. Network analysis, who is talking to who and at what scale, is the main tool used in this field.
You could kind of say that the methodology is the same now as it was in their day, but obviously, no,
I'm sure
GCHQ
wouldn't, but we're uninformed, definitely.
Definitely at the top,
parallels,
you know, definitely at the top level, once you get into the weeds of the detail, and obviously this would not have been declassified if it was really, really, really secret.
Mm-hmm.
But there are definite parallels.
It's the reason Welshman has so many problems when he writes his book as well, isn't it?
Things haven't been declassified at that point. Yeah.
So maybe that's one of the reasons Sixter has gone unrecognised for so long.
Till now.
Till I write my book on it.
Watch this space. David, do you agree that Sixter is the most underrated of all of these sections?
Well, I'm going to go back to your original question. And of all the most underrated huts, I'm going to pick a hut.
An actual hut.
An actual hut. Okay. An actual standing building. This is Hut 10, which started out as Hut 10 and, unusually for a Bletchley Park hut, stayed Hut 10 throughout its life.
And is still standing today.
And is still standing today. Although it's not open to the public currently.
No, indeed.
This was an air section hut, which, amongst its other activities, housed the meteorological section. We've had horology. We're now going to do meteorology.
Meteorology.
Air section obviously expanded and moved on, but the weathermen, the meteorologists, stayed in Hut 10.
And weather women.
And weather women. Weather people. And you say, well, why does Bletchley have a weather section? Why does the air section have a team of meteorologists? Some of them are meteorologists, some of them are code breakers, but they're working on meteorological
code-breaking meteorologists.
Code-breaking meteorologists. Because one of the things that not only the Germans, all armies do, all military forces do, every day, is they need weather forecasts. You can't conduct military operations unless you know, and naval operations, unless you know what the weather's going to be like. So everybody is sending weather messages. And critically for GCNCS, the Germans are sending weather messages enciphered with Enigma. And one of the ways you can break Enigma is if you can create a crib, if you can guess what the content of the message is likely to be. And the classic crib that always gets quoted when everyone talks about breaking Enigma is weather forecast, is Wetterfuhrsagen, where it's this idea that because the message is sent at a particular time every day, and a bit like shipping forecast, it has a very stereotyped format, you can predict what that format's going to be, and therefore you can use weather messages as a really easy way, well, not an easy way, a way to break into Enigma.
A predictable way.
A predictable way. And the other thing that happens is quite often, because not everybody in the German Navy, for example, is using Enigma, not necessarily exactly the same message, but a very similar message might be sent using a hand cipher or a dockyard cipher or one of the other more easily breakable systems. And so if you can read it in that breakable system, you can then apply that to Enigma. So studying German weather forecasts is actually a really, really key part of the code-breaking process and the cribbing process. It has a double payoff, if you like, because not only do you get to use their weather messages to break their codes, but you also get the information contained in the weather messages. Having German weather ships in the Arctic Ocean sending in weather forecasts every day is useful to the Royal Navy as well as to the Kriegsmarine. So there is a weather benefit. Just how much of the weather information is useful? We know that they were talking to Dunstable, which was the main wartime weather station of weather operations in Britain. We know they were talking to Dunstable. So it's quite possible that they were sharing German meteorological stats with Dunstable. But their main function is as a part of the code-breaking operation to exploit weather traffic to break codes. But it does mean that you have a team of weathermen and weatherwomen, code-breakers, in Hut 10.
I mean, all respect to Sixter, but I think I want to be a code-breaking meteorologist when I grow up, certainly.
No, I'm going to have to side with Tom on this. I think the weathermen are over-egging the pudding. They were just drawing clouds.
Well, keeping a weather eye on the time, I think we may have come to the end of our questions.
I think we've got one more question, which is, so which is your favourite hut, Erica?
I wouldn't want to be partisan.
Actually, there's a hut which I think deserves all the credit, which we haven't mentioned yet, which is Hut 2.
Hut 2,
The beer hut.
I think that might be my favourite hut. Yes, I have to agree. The opportunity for refreshment in exchange for beer tokens, I believe.
And a lending library.
What better way to spend a quiet hour relaxing? Absolutely.
Mine's the present day Block D. Because it's decrepit and dank. I think that says more about me than it does about Blexley.
All the D words.
Ripe with opportunity.
Well, yeah, let's put it that way.
And asbestos.
I think these episodes have been really enjoyable, getting the four of us together. It's been really enjoyable to answer the listeners' questions.
I think so. I think some appropriate myths have been busted out of the water.
And maybe we'll do this again. Maybe we've not such a bigger gap this time. So from up in the mansion at Bletchley Park, we're all going to say goodbye now. And we hope, if you did send a question in, that we've answered it for you. Bye!
Bye.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.